Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 3 minutes after 1 p.m. Tuesday, March 13, 2012 for the afternoon section. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, and Senator Thomas. We are going to modify the schedule. We're going to, as earlier posted, we're going to continue with the hearing on Senate Bill 192. And depending on how that goes, if we can complete it, fine. If not, we'll stop roughly at somewhere around 2 o'clock, and then we'll pick up with the capital budget. So with that, Senator Pascman. Senator Pascman's in the process of presenting Senate Bill 192. He's on page 60 of his presentation. If you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, please, and then pick up the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Joe Pascman, Senator for Fairbanks, and joining me today is my Chief of Staff, Mr. Jeff Stepp. Turning now directly to page 60 in the presentation, I found that the information that was conveyed by Director Kevin Banks, and he's the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas for the Alaska Department of Natural Resource, and he made a presentation to the United States Senate on May 10th, 2011, so a little less than a year ago. And he's talking about the issues of production and throughput potentially through the TAP system. And he's talking about, obviously, the potentials for heavy oil, the potentials for shale oil. But then his concluding sentence, I think, is very important. Quote, there are no known conventional resources on state or native lands that are likely sufficient to replace the decline in the existing production rates. So again, I think that this is coming directly from the Director of Alaska's Division of Oil and Gas. Again, while we should remain optimistic as to the sources such as heavy oil and shale oil and outer continental shelf issues, as far as the Central North Slope and conventional oil, this information is very poignant from the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. On page 61, this is part of the presentation to the Senate Resources Committee of March 1, 2012, so just about a week and a half ago. And I asked a question of Mr. Scott Jepson. He's the Vice President for ConocoPhillips. And I asked him about the goal of 1 million barrels a day and its connection with conventional oil coming from the Central North Slope and the $5 billion investment that Alaskans have been hearing about. And one of the comments that they made is that the expenditure of that $5 billion, while it would commence within the next 3 years, it would be spent over the next 6 to 10 years. So that kind of sets the context of the question by myself to Mr. Jepson. And I really did appreciate Mr. Jepson's honesty in his response. He just said, you know, it's a good aspirational goal, but he doesn't think we can get there from, you know, with conventional oil. And he addresses the sense of optimism that we all hope to have as far as technologies that may increase throughput that comes from shale oil or the heavy oil. But again, he doesn't see the upside in terms of getting to the million barrels a day accessing conventional oil from the Central North Slope. Again, remaining optimistic as to technologies further opening up the basin for shale and heavy. On page 62, addressing the production and employment booms and talking about the resurging North American oil production issues, we've seen, and this was to some extent addressed earlier today, how technology created an upheaval in the North American natural gas markets. And this slide, which is from February 15, 2012, so approximately a month ago, is talking about the issues of the transfer of that technology that transformed the natural gas field and the transfer of that technology and the promise of that technology to improving oil production in the United States using that technology. And then in the last paragraph or last sentence or so, They talk about the advances in the horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing have unlocked vast reserves of hydrocarbons originally trapped in highly dense shale rocks. And they're talking about then the two shale oil plays that have so far benefited most from that transformational technology, which is the Bakken in North Dakota and the Eagle Ford in Texas. And I, as well as in agreement with Mr. Jepson, hope that that shale oil and heavy oil soon arrives and benefits the state of Alaska. Now, for the next four or five slides, these are rig counts that Mr. Stepp from my office, I think, could just walk briefly through to indicate to the committee members exactly what these slides are intended to represent so that one can have a better sense of how we as Alaska jurisdiction compare with, for example, North Dakota or Texas. So if I may, Mr. Chair, defer to Mr. Stepp.
Thank you, Senator Pascan. Again, for the record, my name is Jeff Stepp. You've heard Senator Pascan say recently that Alaskans expect the policymakers to act like sophisticated owners of a world-class resource. Part of being a sophisticated owner of that resource is performing a sophisticated analysis of the issues that come before the body. And there have been a lot of comparisons made between Alaska and especially North Dakota and Texas. And this part of the slideshow drills down into that a little more. Going back to the last slide, as it says, the unrelenting increase in oil rig count has been driven by two forces, the sustained high price of the commodity and the promise of improved oil production using the technology that's transformed the gas sector, meaning horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. And as we look at these maps, and these are from the they're actually from an app, and these are from an iPad app called the Baker Hughes Rig Count, and there are filters on there where you can go look at any geographic region in the United States and take a look at both the oil and the gas wells. So this map is confined to the gas well, or I'm sorry, to the oil wells or oil rigs, and this is, in fact, the Bakken shale play in North Dakota. And obviously there's a lot of rigs there. The active rig count for today, according to the Baker Hughes rig count website and app, is 196, and all of these rigs are for shale oil play, something that currently doesn't exist in the state of Alaska. Another point that this slide reveals, especially when you look at a little zoomed in area here of the Bakken, is that there's a whole lot of more infrastructure in North Dakota than there is on Alaska's North Slope. You can see, you can't see so well on the map, but on the screen, but I hope you can see on your handouts. You can definitely see the many state highways. In addition to those state highways, there are a lot of little county roads, and they're approximately every mile going north and south and every mile going east and west. So in performing that little more sophisticated analysis of the difference between Alaska and North Dakota and Texas, there's a lot of factors to consider, and one of them that's revealed by these maps is the access to infrastructure in addition to the access to a different kind of technology, hydraulic fracturing.
So I think we want to accelerate through these slides and try to stick with the stuff that was actually at the Resource Committee.
Okay.
Turning to Mr. Chair, slide 69, there was a presentation about the production booms and employment booms, and this was an article that appeared in the Alaska Economic Trends in 2008. And again, it's, I believe, a well-understood fact that there have been dramatic improvements in technology over the last decade, and they address here the issues of horizontal drilling, ultra-extended reach drilling, 3D and 4D seismic, drill bit sensors, and other advancements, and the purpose of that is that technology has reduced the number of wells that need to be drilled. And again, you know, that while you may not always see that on a bar graph chart, the number of wells that need to be drilled now in 2012 are substantially fewer than they were a decade or so ago. On slide 70, again, this is in that same September 2008 Alaska Economic Trends. They talk about that the national oil and gas industry was a leader in productivity gains, and the oil industry has been able to perform more work using fewer workers. And the point is again, returning to one of my earlier indications, is that the industry goal of fewer workers does not necessarily match up with the state's goal of trying to have as many Alaskan workers working as possible. The motivation, obviously, from industry is to continue to develop technologies to perform more work using fewer workers, and certainly policymakers should expect and anticipate those advances in technology. On page 71, again, comparing Alaska to other jurisdictions, you know, the first quote, you know, a person wouldn't guess that by looking at the size of Alaska oil's industry workforce as where our importance really was in the nation. But again, that last side where Alaska produces 15% of the nation's domestic oil supply but employed only 3% of the oil and gas workforce. Again, it's because of the efficiencies of operation in Alaska, again, another well-recognized and well-understood fact of operations in Alaska. Slide 72, again, how does Alaska compare to other oil-producing states? The second bullet point there is, again, Alaska's oil fields enjoy large economies of scale. The Prudhoe Bay is the largest oil field in the nation and doesn't need a huge workforce to produce the production that comes out of it. And the reference there is to example these other jurisdictions, Texas, Oklahoma, Wyoming, where oil is produced from very small fields, and they talk about the number of these marginal fields or the stripper wells, and method of oil extraction that is essentially totally absent in the state of Alaska. And Mr. Chair, you'll recall that when we were in Texas in December of 2011, where we were told that the average well in the state of in the state of Texas produces less than 5 barrels a day, something that is totally unknown in the state of Alaska, where our production per well is greatly in excess of that type of stripper well operation. Turning now to the next slide, slide 73, again talking about the production issue and employment issues, comparing Alaska with other jurisdictions, talking about the technological advances have led to more drilling and more jobs in the unconventional plays in North Dakota, but at the same time, those technological advances lead to fewer wells and fewer jobs in the mature conventional oil plays in Alaska's North Slope. And again, we do await for the application of the technology in both conventional oil resources and heavy and shale, and hope for breakthroughs in those areas so that we can get increased throughput. And I believe that it would at that time that we have the breakthroughs in shale and heavy oil, that it would be more appropriate to compare Alaska to Texas and North Dakota after the application of the breakthroughs in Alaska than now. Page 74, again, just briefly going through this, it is not disputed by anyone. The Alaska North Slope is and remains a world-class basin. The Prudhoe Bay field remains as one of the 10 biggest fields in the world. Talking about the vertical integration of the big three on the Central North Slope, the understanding that the dollars are made not just at the wellhead, but to ultimate distribution from the upstream to the midstream, Alaska is very attractive. We are in a period of transition from majors only to majors plus mid-majors and independents. That is a transition that is occurring. Also addressing the issue of national oil companies have limited the areas which in which investments may be made. And then lastly, in this concept of immobile capital, to some extent that addresses the concept of sunk costs, where it you know, the incentive is to keep those functioning as long as possible. We do have a significant infrastructure that has been developed on the Central North Slope, and it remains attractive, I believe, to the industry. Very quickly, going into the last main substantive section of the presentation, and this begins on page 75, I will start now addressing the committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 to address the issues that of what is included in that bill, so that and if the chair would like, when I talk about these specific components, if you would like, I can have Mr. Stepp provide the specific sections within the bill so that you can find them, whatever the chair would prefer.
Well, I'd like you just to go ahead and walk through it, and the committee members will flag me if they want to
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Zero in on a particular issue.
First of all, on page 76, commencing rationale of what was intended to be accomplished was to preserve the industry-friendly components of ACEs. We also wanted to reduce the rate and the cap on progressivity. We wanted to reward increased production. We wanted to establish a gross minimum tax, and we wanted to separate the or decouple the oil and natural gas taxes for purposes of calculating the taxes within the state of Alaska. And lastly, on a more general basis, create an oil information system so that in the future access to information would hopefully be more readily available to policymakers than it's, in my opinion, we currently have access to. So turning to page 77, again, what are some of the industry-friendly components of ACEs that have been preserved? Specifically, it preserves the deductions for all of the capital expenditures, all of the operating, I shouldn't say all, but there are qualified capital expenditures, operating expenditures, and transportation costs. That is preserved so that we give them the incentives of those deductions so that when the calculation of the production taxes is applied, it's after the removal of those preserved deductions. We've also maintained the tax credits. For example, with the capital expenditures, for the same dollar that they can deduct, and they can deduct 100% of the dollar spent in the year spent, for that same dollar they get a 20% credit to their bottom line. Very powerful incentive for investment in Alaska. It preserves the royalty rate. We found that Alaska's royalty is very attractive to the industry in the sense of its range is between 12.5, which is predominant royalty rate, to as high as about 16%. Royalty rates in other jurisdictions range from 25 and even 30% when one looks at North Dakota or Texas. Lastly, we preserve the concept of royalty modification so that if an operator in Alaska is able to prove that they need assistance, we can come in and through the Department of Revenue and the Department of Natural Resources, that royalty modification, reducing that royalty from 12.5 or 15, 16%, can be reduced down to as much as 3%. So that we can keep the fields online, can keep them producing oil, and can keep taps as full as possible. So that's kind of the preservation of the industry-friendly components of the ACEs structure as it currently exists. On page 78, specifically addressing the reduction in the rate of progressivity and reduction in the cap on progressivity, the bill retains the original trigger of $30 in production tax value. And again, that production tax value is assessed after the deductions for transportation costs and after the deductions for qualified capital expenditures and operating expenditures. Then there is that $30 gap where the called a production tax value, where it is maintained at the base 25%. From that point, the rate of progressivity was reduced from a 0.4 per dollar increase in production tax value. It was reduced to a 0.35 per dollar increase, and that was capped at 50%. at that 50% range. Then we did a second trigger, or we applied a second trigger to further reduce the rate of progressivity from 0.35 to 0.1, and did that just for an additional 10% to 60%. And we've capped progressivity at 60%, which is a reduction from the current cap at 75%. So the reductions are significant and material, and that is the point of slide 78. With respect to rewarding increased production, we, as part of the joint Senate Finance and Senate Resources Committee hearing, we did hear from Pedro Van Meurs, and one of the concepts that he advanced was that of an allowance for increase or new oil or incremental oil. And so it was believed important to make sure that there was a component in the CS for Senate Bill 192 to provide a reward for new oil or to provide a reward for incremental oil. And this, again, using that concept of production tax value, an allowance is provided of $10 for each new barrel or incremental oil produced, and that is the intent of that component of 192, Mr. Chair. Also, in slide 80 now, we're turning to the establishing a gross minimum tax. As much as it was believed that there needed to be an adjustment for the oil industry at high oil prices, where is the reason for the reduction from the 0.4 to the 0.35, it was also believed that in the potential volatility of oil pricing, so that we may experience a wide spectrum of pricing, that there was a need to also balance at a risk to the state of Alaska at low oil prices, what revenues that the state of Alaska could rely upon. And so we believe that it was appropriate to establish a gross minimum tax of 10%. And these are only on the legacy fields of Kuparuk and Prudhoe, just so that we know that the revenue stream from those two fields will always have a minimum floor. And again, the consultants told us that ACES needs to be durable in a wide range of price environments, and this is a mechanism, I believe, to establish durability for the state of Alaska and protect the state's downside risk. Slide number 81, again, this is addresses a separation of the oil and natural gas taxation systems, which is, many people have heard that over the last several years, commonly referred to as decoupling. And the necessity of that is that the tax rate that is applied in Alaska is based on the combined BTU value of oil and gas. And certainly we now know that the value of oil and the BTUs that are created by oil is substantially valued at a higher value than the BTU value of natural gas. And if you don't decouple the tax structure, you have a dilution effect that dramatically reduces revenue stream to the state of Alaska. And so to correct this potential insult to the state of Alaska, it is thought prudent to decouple the tax systems at this time. Lastly, into the substantive aspects of the CS for Senate Bill 192, on slide 82, is the creation of the Oil Information System. And as the owner state, it's believed prudent and wise that as much oil and gas information, both historical and current, as is possible, be assembled so that policymakers in the future will have access to that information to better guide and more easily obtain that information so that their decisions can be founded on better substantive information. This would be created through the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, and it would prepare this electronic petroleum information management system, and it's just to try to make information more readily available to policymakers. Mr. Chair, kind of in concluding, I truly believe that there is more reason for optimism now than there ever has been. We know that there is 7 to 8 billion barrels of conventional oil on the central north slope. Those are proven reserves. In addition to that, we have the heavy oil resources, we have the shale oil resources, we have the undiscovered conventional oil resources. We have the Outer Continental Shelf in both the Beaufort and the Chukchi. We have NPRA and we have ANWR. There's a lot of oil up on the North Slope, and I believe that is a reason for much optimism. We know that the Alaska North Slope, even with just the 7 to 8 billion barrels of conventional resources there, is worth now than it was more than 30 years ago. Because the value of that resource, when one looks at $100 a barrel, is worth much more than it was decades ago when it was at $3 or $5 or $8 a barrel. We've seen that spending forecasts are up, and this is there's been a lot of work performed below ground in the well workovers. We've seen a rebuilding of the infrastructure both below ground and above ground. I believe that it's going to set the stage for a viable and vibrant oil industry for many decades to come. We've heard from Kathy Forrester of AOGCC that the Alaska North Slope is healthy. I agree with the Department of Natural Resources ad that says, Alaska, we're open for business. I think that the world should know that. I believe it's a great message. I believe that we are competitive and we have a world-class resource to offer. There was a headline in the Petroleum News just a few months ago, and the headline was North Slope Booms. I agree with that. We now have, we've heard over the last year, that exploration on the North Slope is at the level really not seen in 40 years. To the extent that there's so much exploration activity, we are rig constrained. There's not enough rigs to perform all of the work that is that the operators on the North Slope are wanting to perform. We've heard about hot sheeting on the central North Slope, where because there's so many people working up there, they have to sleep a guy in the same one bed. One guy sleeps while the other guy's working. They call that hot sheeting. So, again, there's a strong room for optimism. Again, just on slide 85, it's just kind of going through all the major areas. I would say in concluding, Mr. Chair, that I believe the Alaskans want to see the legislature act like a sophisticated owner of a world-class resource, and Alaskans expect that Alaska will obtain the maximum value for Alaska's resources for its citizens. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to provide this presentation.
Okay, we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor before we send him away? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple of just questions regarding information, and thank you for your presentation, Senator Pascan, whether they exist in the binder or not, and that would be Mark Meyer's memo regarding mergers and market concentrations, and if they're contained, you can just say they are or not. I couldn't find them in here. Prudhoe Bay development history and future potential, which refers to slide 31, as well as slides 32 and 33, Prudhoe Bay field facility constraints, and the optimization of production from mature fields, slide 34. If that information is contained in here, I didn't find it. So
we will promptly provide those articles and any other article that this committee would request.
And one other last little item was the regarding slide 60, the remarks made by then Director of Oil and Gas Kevin Banks that were made to the United States Senate about a year ago, I guess it was. If you've ever heard from anybody in the departments, any of the departments, administration or natural resources, that his remarks were either false or misleading.
No, I believe they are true then and they are true now.
Thank you.
We could ask the department, they'll speak for themselves. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not labeled, but it's the last page that we have in our handouts. It's from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas, the last statement says that the past 2 years of lease sales at the North Slope successfully leased a total of 1,276,000 acres to small companies. Do we know what, how many wells have been drilled on those leases in the last 2 years?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I do not know the number of wells.
We can have the department respond back to that question so we have accurate information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Passman, thank you for your presentation and your work. And I didn't get an opportunity to follow all the work of the Resources Committee, so I just wondered if you could quickly tell me and the committee what some of the discussion might have been in the committee related to lease terms and the duty to produce, and then if there was any discussion of state direct financial investment, SDFI, to better align industry and state interests like some other regions do. And then finally, facilities access. I know some of my colleagues have brought that up with me, and I've spoken with folks in the industry who just say, well, it's just, there's no problem with facilities access. It's just a business negotiation that might happen someday to someone's satisfaction, or maybe not, but it's just a commercial transaction that could occur in the future. Was there anything that came up in the committee on lease terms, SDFI, and then facilities access?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, yes, all of those topics did come up, and one of my initial slides in this presentation included the remarks of Bob Bartlett at the Constitutional Convention. And the second issue that he raised at the Constitutional Convention, when it did come to Alaska's resource potential, was on the issue of the acquisition of large tracts of land with the intent not to purchase. And that issue was raised at the Senate Resources Committee in the sense of there are exclusive rights provided under the lease structure that can be for 10 years, and they get to the end of that 10 years and there's been no exploration, there's been no development, and certainly there's no production. And the question is, do they just tender them back to the state of Alaska? So in part, that concept of duty to explore, duty to develop, and duty to produce was a source of significant discussion at the Senate Resources Committee. With respect to state direct financial investment, that was also discussed at the Senate Resources Committee, and facility access. And those, as I indicated to every member of the Senate Resources Committee, you know, the ideas that came from the committee members were all valid ideas, all well thought out, all good substantive concepts. But the question is do you try to confine a tax bill to the tax components? And that's where, so to speak, where you got to leave some footage on the cutting room floor to try to keep the tax bill as precise as possible. So that was, I guess, getting to the ultimate question of why is certain information included or certain segments included in the Senate Bill 192 and others are not because they're not good ideas. And I hope that through the remainder of this session, particularly on the duty to produce, that these issues will be more well developed.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Passman, that was an excellent, all-encompassing, and quite a broad-breadth presentation that you had. But one of the interesting things I found was the Gleason decision. And I realize it was those things that were brought up were in a different arena, in a different setting, but certainly some of the questions that we have here are of the same nature. And I was wondering, at least what I listened to it, there seems to be a difference of opinion of what we're hearing either in the media or otherwise. But I was wondering, are there any points in that decision that are being either appealed or reconsidered or something to that effect where there may be another date that's put forward instead of 2065 or 2075?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes as to most of the questions. Specifically, there was a request by the state for reconsideration, and just last week the state rejected, or the judge, and there, what kind of complicated this process, Judge Gleason was a sitting state superior court judge. In the middle of this process, she was nominated and is now a U.S. Federal district court judge. And so there was a transfer from Judge Gleason to Judge Guidi. Judge Guidi last week denied the state's application with respect to one component of the decision. So Judge Guidi supports Judge Gleason's opinion. It has not been appealed yet, but I certainly would anticipate, as in the normal process of any litigation, that it would be appealed. But currently it has not been appealed for tax years 2007, 8, and 9.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And seeing no other questions, thank you for presenting that work. We're going to stand at ease while we set up for the capital budget. We're at ease. Let's go ahead and bring the committee back to order. Now we're going to go on to a capital budget, Senate Bill 160. This will be the 13th hearing on the capital budget. We're going to start today with the University of Alaska, then we're going to go to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the Department of Public Safety dealing with the overviews, or the inclusions, I guess, in the governor's proposed capital budget. With us today from the university, is Mr. Gamble. If he can introduce himself for the record, please, and take us through the governor's proposed budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Pat Gamble, president of the University of Alaska System, and I'm here today to talk about our capital budget. And I think on the phone we have Dr. Mark Myers, who is head of research for University of Alaska Fairbanks, and we have Ms. Kit Duke, who runs facilities and land management for the university system. Mr. Chair, my introductory briefing actually is pretty short for today because there's really only one item in the governor's budget that made it through, and that was the $37.5 million that we received last year and the year before as part of a five-year program for capital, primarily to reduce deferred maintenance and what we call R&R, or replacement and renovation. With a little bit of background, when I was before you last year, it was my first time with the budget, and I had gone forward and proposed a two-year program in which we were going to take a look at what was really the financial situation with regard to the state and the university, go back and look at some assumptions we were making, hold the line in accordance with the governor's budget, and we flattened that budget considerably, and that flattening found its way into the capital side by virtue of the fact that we didn't ask for any planning money or any programming money with regard to new projects. We had a very generous bond issuance, as you may remember, that we were going to be dealing with, and we had a couple of items that were under construction, and so our plate was fairly full, except for the area of deferred maintenance. And we had such a serious deferred maintenance problem, as I came on board and looked at it and talked to the chancellors and talked to Kit Duke, that we got together and identified that as our number one priority for the university system across the system. That's not an academic priority, that's a facilities priority. I also forecasted that for 2 years we were probably going to stay pretty lean and mean in terms of not wanting to go out and build a lot of new stuff while we tried to figure out how we were going to deal with this deferred maintenance problem. And again, in saying that, I was taking into account the fact that we had already been generously given the dollars to do quite a bit of construction anyway. And so the idea that we were asked to bring in a flat budget, the idea that the O&M budget was pretty flat, and the idea that we were going to grow and increase as we had for over 10 years, year to year to year, substantially, those days were over. And we went across the entire campus and tried to tell a number of our employees, some of whom never knew anything but growth. They've been with us for 10 years, and every single budget year they saw it grow, that those days were over and that it was at least going to be flat. And depending on the way the economy went a year ago, it could go the other way, like the schools in the lower 48 that we were watching very carefully. This year is very much a carbon copy of last year in terms of our priorities. Our number one priority across the entire system is deferred maintenance. It's a very, very serious issue with us. It's not our number one academic priority. That's engineering. But in terms of the overall consequences with regard to the length and breadth of how deferred maintenance and the need for R&R, or repurposing, is beginning to filter into virtually every corner of the university where the buildings aren't relatively new. And as you well know, we have probably, I'm pretty sure I can say, the largest single ownership of state facilities in the state, single owner, and many of those facilities are getting quite old. And so the question as to how to upkeep, how to programmatically keep those up, is one that is facing us now, because we haven't been programmatic about the way we've been keeping the facilities up. We come in every year and we ask for some R&R money, or we ask for our maintenance money, which has generally been funded fully, by the way. Operations and maintenance money has been generously funded. But the repurposing dollars for things like an engineering laboratory that was built in 1964, when I was still using a slide rule as a freshman in college, that becomes an accreditation problem today when the engineers today are so far ahead of what we were dealing with when we built those buildings. And so we've rolled that all into what we call our R&R issue and our deferred maintenance issue. They're connected, but they're separate. In other words, you can work R&R, and that is at about 25 years or so, buildings start to show their age, and so you go in and you recondition the building and give it another 25 or 30 years. And if you don't do that, then the building continues to deteriorate, as you know, and then at some point it reverts to potential failure for an HVAC system, or for a roof that finally is old and leaky and starts to give way, or as we find out too often, we have a lot of asbestos in the facilities that were built early on. And when we don't take care of those in a programmatic way, they end up being on the deferred maintenance list. And that list just simply accumulates and grows and is now of such size that to turn that curve around and bring it down the other way, the dollar amounts are rather staggering. The tendency is to not want to deal with those large numbers because they're so competitive with so many other needs of the state. And that's where we understand how difficult your job is when you're confronted with these things. But at the same time, you're asking for our best technical advice on how to proceed with the state's property. And so, therefore, we bring, again, a flat capital budget, one in which we're asking for deferred maintenance money, but not new programming money and not new design and preliminary engineering money. We requested last year $50 million for R&R, which on an annual basis, if we get $50 million every year, that is the number that programmatically would take care of R&R not becoming an increasingly large number like deferred maintenance, or shifting to deferred maintenance. We got two out of that ask last year out of 50. We asked for permission to sell bonds and internally repay those bonds for $100 million, and you all, again, gave us the authorization. We appreciated that to the last day, when that number was cut in half to 50. We've since put as much of that money to work already as we possibly can, and we're putting the rest of it to work as fast as we can, too, on specifically identified, pre-identified projects that represent the sense of urgency as expressed by each of the main campuses along with their community campuses. Now, we didn't go in there and divide that money up and say, you all get an equal or proportional share of the money, figure out what your projects are. The approach was, which of your deferred maintenance projects are of such risk that you feel you need to have the money right now, and that the other ones that we can't afford would take a secondary position. And that is what turned out to be the $100 million. In other words, it wasn't a pre-programmed figure. We actually added up the priorities that were high risk, mission failure potential, and it turned out to be $100 million. So we asked for that authority to sell the bonds. We got it, and it was cut in half at the end of the budget cycle. So we're back again this year because that deferred maintenance number is not an optional number that goes away if we don't fund it in 1 year. The option to take it or make it into a program, or it doesn't go away, it just accumulates. And I know how you understand that. So it was quite discouraging, and we realized we had a lot of work to do when we came back in this year, asked for another $100 million, and it was all taken out. And then we asked for the R&R money, and that was all taken out as well. It wasn't 2 like last year out of 50, it was 0 out of 50. So with the 37.5, the rate of accumulation of deferred maintenance when you're up in the $750 and $800 million bracket total, the rate of accumulation from year to year now starts to compete with the amount of money that the governor has been giving us to reduce deferred maintenance. But it doesn't reduce anything. What it basically does is it slows the growth, but the growth just continues to accumulate. These are actual physical properties that we're talking about. It's not just money. So we've got our work cut out for us in order to take the 37.5, and then we asked for $15 million in receipt authority in case we were able to get federal money sometime during the year, which we were granted, and then turn around and try to apply this. Now, I've summarized this whole thing in a chart that we kind of knowing or laughingly call the mother of all charts, because what it does is it arithmetically and graphically links the discussion I just had with you together on a single chart. And what this chart does is it talks about and it can show you what happens if you do something. If you add money in this pot or if you add money in this pot, we change the graph and can show you what the effect was. What the effect of not getting the dollars last year had, even though we got the $50 million and the $37.5 million, for example, the deferred maintenance number went from $750 million total down to about $710 million. So we slowed growth, but that growth begins all over again as soon as we stop putting programmatic dollars into this model, if you will. So we're back again this year, essentially following the same model, essentially concerned about the same things, with a couple of ideas about how in the future, and perhaps next year in more depth, we could discuss how do we get to a programmatic approach to getting these dollars in every year so that we go into a sustainment mode that essentially says we don't need any more money and we can't take any less money. We're in a band right here that is designed to sustain the facilities that we have, fix them up again at the 25-year or 30-year point, add the life to them, do the operating and maintenance, and then at the same time have enough money left over to actually bring that huge deferred maintenance number back down to something that's reasonable. Reasonable for us is something in the mid-300s instead of the mid-700s or 800s with regard to deferred maintenance. Now, why is that a big deal? It's a big deal because, again, in the physical world out there where these buildings exist, when you get deferred maintenance and you have buildings that are in that status for a long time, as you well know, risk goes up at failure. It can be an HVAC failure. It can be a roof failure. It could be the plumbing that happened in one of our dormitories a couple of years ago. And at some point, these things fail. One of our engineering buildings, for example, was built in 1983. Doesn't seem like that long ago. 1983, the first F-16s were starting to fly in the United States Air Force. It was a brand new airplane. I was a young pilot and wanted to fly one very, very bad. Today, those same airplanes are in the boneyard. They're just made of metal and plastic and rubber, and they age out, and when they age out, they're no good anymore. And they are in the boneyard. Our buildings don't go in the boneyard. They go to deferred maintenance. And then they fail. And when something fails, we have to go into the execution year O&M dollars that were programmed to get those buildings through the year of execution in the budget and borrow from Peter to pay Paul and go in and fix the deferred maintenance problem. And it's a Band-Aid. And the more we do of that, the more you see our O&M money, instead of going where you intended it to go, is being pulled out as an emergency way to fix a deferred maintenance problem. And the best example, I think, is Scarlin Hall, one of our high-rise dormitories at UAF, which was brought down because the internal plumbing failed within the concrete itself. And we had to drill through concrete and go in and change all the plumbing systems in the entire high-rise. Took the building down for a couple of years. All those students had to find someplace else to live. We lost the revenue and so on and so forth. That's just an example of when an entire structure goes over to deferred maintenance. So I give you these examples, not so much to ask just for dollars for this year, but to agree that you would consider tasking us to try to find a programmatic way so that besides taking the dollars that we could get, that we actually come back with something that represents a programmatic way to work this problem as opposed to the sort of the serendipity of a year-to-year-to-year basis, because we've seen that go up and down, and it's very difficult to program anything in the future with funding like that for this kind of a particular problem. Having said that, by way of introduction, Mr. Chair, I will say that we're talking about the governor's budget. We're not talking about the one that I built. That's a different budget, and as you might expect, you know, that was reduced. And so, I'm not bringing that part up, just to let you know that there was a difference there between the two. And also to make sure that it's clear that we've gone through a significant scrub of what we call deferred maintenance, so that there's no gamesmanship in there where somebody is saying, well, gee, if we get money for deferred maintenance, if I move this project into that category, I'll get my money maybe. Truth in lending is it goes a lot to our credibility when we're talking about big numbers like this, and these are actual projects by campus that are intended to be funded and were intended to be funded last year by any dollars that come into us for the category of R&R and DM. So I just want to let the committee know that work has already been done to scrub those projects.
Senator Hoffman, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the projects, and I'm fully aware of the importance of deferred maintenance and taking care of the facilities. I think when I was chairman of the other body many years ago, it was the first time the University of Alaska received any line item referred to as deferred maintenance. So I'm well aware of it. But I'm looking at some of these, like on page 3, a third from the bottom, parking security for $2.5 million. On page 4, you have Matsu door lock key access, $561,000. A master plan for $6 million for the lower campus. The Paddy Center renovation, basketball courts, swimming pools, and such, basically sports-orientated, for $3.6 million. Below that, campus roads, sidewalks, curbs, gutters, and ramps for another $6 million. And I go back to my district, and there are some campuses, community campuses out there. And this last winter, unrelated but quite similarly, the Lower Kuskokwim School District resulted in a failure because we had chill factors down to 60 below for and 40 below for an extended period of over 30 days. And the Kuskokwim campus has similar problems to HV HVAC upgrades that are needed. Teachers and students are experiencing headaches, and the mechanical system is quite old and is in need of repair. During that cold spell, many individuals had to spend the night to maintain the system for 24 hours a day. And I don't know if that these would be considered as maintenance, renewal, repair, or would be considered something that would be in the operating budget. But to me, you know, I think it would qualify to be a higher category than security and parking. And I'm wondering, I'm not really asking for my fair share. 20% of $37.5 million would be $7 million, and the repairs here are about $400,000. And I'm wondering how something like that, and maybe others that are in more remote places that are off the rail belt in rural campuses, how, what are their needs? Do you have a list of those?
Yes, we do, Senator. For example, Kuskokwim campus facility, critical deferred, their number one priority is a $5.1 million project. What we see is if we only got the $37.5 million, the portion of that that would go to Lower Kuskokwim would be $900,000. The higher the number that we would be able to bring in for deferred maintenance, that doesn't buy out that project. Our goal is to buy out the project for 5.1. So proportionally, the dollars would go up as the dollars come in across this entire list. These lists were sent to us by the campuses themselves. That's how they were accumulated.
But this particular problem, I think, falls in more of a health, life, safety issue. If people are, the VAC, HVAC system needs to be upgraded, if people are having headaches, if the whole mechanical system is of the age that if it wasn't babied along, we'd have complete freeze-ups. It would seem that would have a higher ranking than parking and security, so to speak. In my view, I don't know what your guidelines are, but in my view, that would rise to a higher level than security and maybe clearing the parking garage, parking areas of snow.
Through the chair, there's no question that, and I'll look into this because I had not heard about the headaches, but if there's a safety issue, then all bets are off. The dollars that we have, whether they're O&M dollars, or whatever it takes, we go in and mitigate a safety issue or a health concern. And that's first and foremost. But that, and I need to get some more information, Senator, to see if there's something there that hasn't bubbled up to my level yet with regard to something more recent within the environment of the building there.
I could provide it to you.
Okay, I'd be happy to take it. And the other point I'd like to make is that these are not, this vertical list here, that's not a priority list. These are all what they said were the urgent deferred maintenance projects, and they're all in the urgent category, but they're not prioritized.
Okay, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. And thank you, Mr. President. I would like to see you come back after a meeting with Dan Fauske, is my hope, to look at the loan program that we originated under our omnibus energy package. There's $250 million in it available under AHFC for any kind of upgrades that you can make to upgrades and replacements, roof repair, HVAC systems, windows. I see in one of the campuses you're looking at renovating the entire power infrastructure that's statewide. It just is another option, especially when we're in these tight budget times. If any of these could roll onto that to free up space for Senator Hoffman's area, or perhaps additional things that could come on, I'd just like to see an assessment of that.
So if you can get back to the committee on the status report, we'll be fine.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I can certainly do that. In fact, I'm having a meeting with Mr. Fauske next week, as it turns out, and we can discuss that.
Perfect.
We have any other questions for Mr. President? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. President. On the colorful sheet that you had here, you have a line called the status quo line, and that is defined as deferred maintenance backlog without adequate R&R. What is considered the adequate R&R number, since we've talked about 100 million and then getting 37 and 50 was a different time? So what would be that number that allows the status quo line to go away, obviously, and us to get down to more like the solid green line that ends up just below at the 362.5? Is that the 100 million?
The assumption on this chart, starting in 213, the light blue is assuming that if we were to get programmatically $50 million every year for R&R, okay. And that's a big if, but if we were, then you would notice that the deferred maintenance line still goes up, but it goes up at a controllable slope relative to the steeper slope, which I actually had them run. I said, what if nothing happens? What if we absolutely don't do anything? And then if you look at that dotted green line, the chart you don't have, which I have, which turns into a dotted red line, that slope goes up by 15 or 20 degrees in terms of steepness. So the assumption on this chart is that the $50 million would help flatten that line considerably. But it doesn't take care of the accumulated deferred maintenance. That in and of itself is a separate group of projects, which when they are completed, that's what turns into the downsloping green line. If we were to get, for example, if we got the $100 million last year, you see that very light line prior to the downsloping green line,
mm-hmm.
That's the year prior? That's what would have happened if we'd have gotten last year what we asked for. But we didn't, and so it kicked it to the right, and you can see that we decreased the 750 to about 710, but then as we project out to the right, we see that even with some sizable contributions, O&M is fully funded, for example, in the dark blue in the bottom. The light blue, we're looking at $50 million a year, which is the number we're saying is programmatically the number we need to sustain. But even at that, if we don't put dollars into deferred maintenance as a separate entity, that number can still go up. It goes up slower, but it still goes up.
Thank you. And one other.
I want to go ahead and follow up, and then Senator Ellis.
Just one other minor item. You had a request for $10 million in the Board of Regents budget. And with that money was for Alaska's energy needs, solutions to Alaska energy needs.
Right.
Could you just briefly tell me a little bit more of what the details of that, just briefly anyhow, what that was intended for, the relationship with the Alaska Power Center for Energy and Power and the industry?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, the person that can answer that the best, I think, is Mark Myers, our head of research, and he's on the line. Would it be possible to allow him to answer that question?
Yeah, Mr. Meyer, if you could briefly introduce yourself and make a brief response back to the question, Senator Thomas's question, because we're going to stick to the governor's proposed budget. Otherwise, we'll.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you. For the record, Mark Myers, I'm the Vice Chancellor for Research at UAF. And the $10 million proposal for energy is a partnership to develop statewide energy. It has three components. The first component is work with Alaska Center on Energy and Power to be able to work on things like the hydrokinetic questions we still have remaining in terms for power, our rural energy systems, the wind diesel coupling, help build out their laboratories research, and answer some key questions with respect to integration of power systems in rural Alaska. All the way from looking at geothermal energy to wind diesel coupling to hydrokinetics, tidal, et cetera. The second piece of this is to do an energy analysis group. We know we have lots of energy options, lots of energy, but getting an apples-to-apples comparison of various projects is a really important piece of the puzzle. And this group would work together to help develop a better understanding of apples-to-apples comparison of projects, projects' advantages, risks, how projects might integrate across the state. The third component of this is an integrated fossil fuels program. We do a fair amount of fossil fuels research, a lot of it funded by industry contributions, but our labs are old, our petroleum research labs are old. Lots of major questions involving shale oil, for example, or enhanced oil recovery, various new techniques for enhanced oil recovery, as well as heavy oil research, and a fair amount of the work that needs to be done on environmental work on the North Slope, for example, with water supplies and potential new infrastructure. Investment in an integrated fashion that could really shorten the cycle time to development of some of these alternative energy sources, particularly unconventional oil on the North Slope.
What we want to do is put
all three of those groups into a single effort Institute of Urban Engineering. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll come back to the – any other questions for the – we'll have I think there's some of those documents on that subject matter that we have or we can get to you, committee members. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, thanks for being here today. Two items. I appreciated you mentioning the engineering, the region's number one non-deferred maintenance capital priority. And several of us, Senator McGuire and myself and Senator Thomas and others, have been trying to build support for that being included in the capital budget this year, the Fairbanks and Anchorage engineering upgrades. Is the industry getting involved? Is there any – I'm trying to light a fire under them, but have they come together to request your full support and enthusiastic push for the engineering buildings? That's the first item. I'm hoping that's happening, but I'm not positive. Second thing is the Senator Begich was here the other day for a joint address to the joint session, and in a meeting following that with the leadership, he mentioned a desire of his that the legislature consider, and it's not in the governor's proposal, it's a new idea, so I'll make this quick because it's not on the governor's wish list, but $5 million to the University of Alaska for unmanned drone program at Eielson Air Force Base. And when I was back in D.C., he brought it up again. He's hyperactively committed to impressing Secretary Panetta and the Pentagon that Alaska can be a center of excellence or center for excellence through the University of Alaska for the unmanned drone, taking advantage of the open airspace around Fairbanks. So could you speak to those two things quickly, because I know the chairman wants to move on.
The answer to your first question with regard to the demand for engineers is a resounding yes. We hear it all the time. And we're looking at all kinds of different engineers. We're looking at corporations inside Alaska who are asking for graduate degree engineers as well as newly minted engineers that they can work into the workforce. They're looking at large-scale retirements coming up. They're forecasting their needs for the future, and their needs in Alaska are for people who can go to work pretty quick and put their hands on Alaska stuff because they know what it is. Our undergraduates have the advantage of being able to partner with the companies working in Alaska in so many different areas. And fisheries, for example, is a huge one. It's not just up on the slope. Mining is another one. And our undergraduates can go out there and put their hands on these things while they're getting their degree. That retention is excellent for Alaska. They stay here, then they come back to grad school, and that's the cycle we're trying to promote. The second item, I also sit on the AMFAS group that's this sort of these military graybeards that are right now sitting with the governor and trying to advise him on issues of military concern within the state or security within the state with regard to national security as it affects Alaska. I also sit as the chairman of the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, the rocket launch site at Kodiak. This idea of Alaska becoming one of the first environments in the entire United States where we put to work and apply drones as well as work out the bugs that the FAA is trying to work out with regard to airspace issues, we are in a very, very unique position of being at the nexus of this whole issue. And it was a very pleasant surprise, because I had not seen this one coming either, that Senator Begich, who is at the forefront of pursuing this idea for Alaska made the request that he made in front of the joint session. But I do know that the work that we're doing at predominantly at UAF with regard to the integration of airspace, safely integrating drone operations into airspace, and the potential that Alaska Aerospace is seeing with bringing drones into Alaska and doing more large-scale drone operations, potentially even out of a place like Eielson for the larger drones. And all the surveillance ideas that are being kicked around, everything from pipeline surveillance to long-dwell drones over the donut hole where you can't see what's going on, and everything in between, these drones are the future. And I think it's a spectacular idea. And Alaska's airspace is so uncomplicated, and encroachment is not a problem in Alaska like it is in Lower 48. We're kind of a natural for all this. And for the university to be a part of it, I'd be a strong endorser of that.
Thank you.
We're going to have to move on here because we've got some more presentations to do. But you have any final comments on the governor's submission?
My only final comment is with regard to the research. You very, very briefly heard a couple of comments from Mark Myers. From what I've seen personally going on, there is some absolutely cutting-edge research going on in the University of Alaska, particularly UAF, with regard to things that are occupying your time at this table in other areas, and you're asking a lot of questions where the scientific information has to be brought from outside someplace. We are fully capable of bringing that information from inside. And what we want to do is to be able to do research that's directly applicable to Alaska's needs for Alaska purposes. And unfortunately, that didn't make the budget last year. It didn't make the budget this year. But as long as I keep hearing you ask those questions, I'm hoping that I can link up our answers to your questions and maybe even do it cheaper than outside consultants, and would strongly advocate for reconsideration of research. It is the seed corn. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Next up, Alaska Housing. Must be the time. And go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and try not to get in the time zone warp like the chairman is.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Fowsky. I'm CEO of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and president of Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation.
I'm Joe Dubler. I'm the vice president, chief financial officer of Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I believe the first item on the list that you have in front of you would be the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation project total in the capital of $21 million, and we would like to discuss that.
Page are you on?
Page 10.
One of one. Page, yes, page 10. I'm sorry.
It is 10.
And then if we could complete that at your desire, and then we can move on to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporate Capital Budget. Is that what you'd like to do?
Yes, that'll be fine. We're going to walk right down. I'm just thinking where we left off.
We left off farther down than that.
Yeah, I think we left off at page 10. As I recall, we'll have a brief at ease.
That was a house.
We're going to start on page 10 under revenue with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and we'll walk right down the list into the Alaska Housing.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Joe Dubler, AGDC, page We're looking at reference number 51753.
Right.
Correct. The fiscal year 2013 request of $21 million in state general funds to continue the efforts of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation to develop an in-state gas pipeline from the Alaska North Slope to the rail belt, with an offtake in Fairbanks and another one in basically the Anchorage area. The request of $21 million will continue engineering, data acquisition and refinement of engineering design, permitting, continue the EIS, environmental impact statement process, the attainment of a federal right-of-way and private rights-of-way, a subsistence impact review, project risk and phasing analysis, commercial analysis, and it will culminate in an open season, we expect, in the end of 2013, calendar year 2013, and preparation of a comprehensive financing plan and public outreach and discussions with the affected parties along the alignment of the pipeline. The $21 million is anticipated to be spent in the following, and I believe that was this passed out to the committee, Mr. Chairman. This is our mother of all spreadsheets. It's the color one. That was a breakdown of the $21 million for fiscal year 2013. Commercial operations are anticipated.
We'll just have a brief at ease. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From that spreadsheet, the commercial operations for fiscal year 2013 are budgeted at $3.8 million. The commercial operations will be to discuss with potential shippers and develop markets for the gas to be shipped down the line, engage work with the Prudhoe Bay operators and owners, and integration plans for the commercial operations. So far, the commercial operations, we've had a successful expression of interest in June of 2011, and now we're working on an open season. The pipeline engineering and environmental permitting is budgeted for $6 million for 2013. The pipeline engineering and permitting is progressing the pipeline route, data collection and design, utilizing the information to upgrade the project design and cost estimates. And what that's doing is refining from the 30% plus or minus 30% interval that we currently have to get it down to plus or minus 10% for our open season. That's going to be the requirement for a successful open season, is to have fairly accurate design and cost estimates. So far, the pipeline engineering has obtained a state right-of-way for state land, and we just received last week a letter from the BLM that once the environmental impact statement process is completed, they will issue us a right-of-way for the federal land. So those are a couple of very large hurdles for this project. We'll have a right-of-way for all the state and federal lands, and then we'll just have to obtain the private rights-of-way, and we've got people working on that right now. So we're obtaining rights-of-way for the entire project.
Senator Hoffman.
What route is that you're talking about for the right-of-way?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that route would be from the North Slope through to Dunbar outside of Fairbanks, with a ladder line going from Dunbar into Fairbanks, and then cutting across the Minto Flats, and then following the Parks Highway down to approximately Big Lake, and then cutting across Big Lake to just by the Little Sioux River, where the current NSTAR project is.
And how was that route determined then, versus other routes?
Through the chair, this is Dan Fauske. Senator Hoffman, that route was determined starting a number of years ago, as first with the work of Harry Noah, then Bob Swenson and others as they continued. And when we took this project on, we continued that analysis and determined that was the route that made was more in compliance with HB 369, which had mandated deliverability of gas from the North Slope down to Tidewater at the least possible cost. As I've testified in the past, we had requested numerous times if there was information that we were lacking in reference to, if you will, the Parks Highway versus the Richardson Highway. The Parks Highway is 93 miles shorter than the Richardson route,
and we had asked for, in consideration of the fact that the pipeline calculates out at about $5 to $6 million a mile, if there was any information and a difference in the two routes that would mitigate a $500 million difference in the selection of the two different routes. So that was the main thrust, and a lot of the work had been done when we came on the project. You also then get into the issue with the federal government determining if you have a likely alternate route. The additional 93 miles then brings into consideration more environmental questions, more wetlands, more all kinds of things that they determine, and then the federal government can get involved in the sense that would they allow you to select an alternative route based on you had a better one from the perspective of the environment going forward. So that was, in a nutshell, if I may, what led to the decision to go. We also, if I may, and then I'll stop, but we were given 1 year from the passage of HB 369 to have a report back to the Senate, by the legislature and to the governor by July 1st of 2011, which we completed. And so there was a lot of quick work that was done and utilizing information that was already in place to go forward.
And maybe you can talk a little bit about overlaps with the GIA and then explain a little bit if there's any interest in any private parties. A lot of us have heartburn with the GIA with a 90% reimbursement, and there's no private enterprise money or very little out of the entirety of the state. In that scenario, we'll have $500 million in a piece of paper that appears as valuable as the piece of papers in the bathrooms. And so I am a little bit concerned that we're not taking a GIA version 2 and heading down the same road where we end up with, in this case, $400 million spent. Tell me why this isn't going to happen and where is private enterprise?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to do that. We held an expression of interest meeting in Anchorage a number of months ago where we had sent out requests to the industry to see what interest there was in the line. These were non-binding requests, but we were anticipating, we weren't sure if people would show. As you know, under the AGEA compact or law, we are limited to 500 million feet of gas a day. If you're below the 68th, or if you're above the 68th parallel, if you're below the 68th parallel, that restriction is lifted. When we held the meetings in Anchorage, there were no questions allowed. It was all people submitted their questions in writing. The total amount of gas needed for Fairbanks, Anchorage, the existing infrastructure that we have, which includes the military bases, and about anything under the sun that you can imagine in that central corridor, was about 240 million feet of gas a day. Our concern was, is there a commercial interest in the remaining 260 million feet of gas? Where we were pleasantly surprised was there was a commercial interest, and in the non-binding reports that we got, a request that there was, we had maxed out the 500 million feet of gas a day with a commercial enterprise, and that gave us great hope in the fact that there is an interest in that commercial activity. Going forward, we are now in the process of discussions with the producers. We've also, in following the mandate that the request that the governor put out in the state of the state in terms of alignment, we have starting involved ourselves in discussions with what that could mean going forward. If, in fact, the big line were to go, as I've testified many times, the work that we're doing could be a spur line, because that's also under, I worked on AGEA as well. That is required under the AGEA compact that there's, I believe it's 5 offtake points. This work then becomes meaningful in that regard. I would like to point out that, Mr. Dubler had just stated, with the letter from the BLM, the EIS that we expect to be done in May, the transfer of the lands under DNR, under the state right-of-way, this project has made incredible progress. Now, as you possibly might remember, but I'd like to remind us, we've taken people through that trumpet curve we show where you're at, FEL, front-end loaded 1, 2, and 3, we're currently at about plus or minus 30%. Our goal is to get out to FEL 3 fall of 2014 into 2015 after we've conducted an open season, and to look at then sanctioning of the project, where then you're at a stage 4, I think, in architectural terms, under the nomenclature that they use. But also we anticipate being at plus or minus 10% to then make the determination that this project is worthwhile. So I remain quite hopeful. As you know, I took this task on to get the report and have worked on it. I like working on things where we feel we're getting something done, and I believe that's the case on this project. In no other terms of just what we've done in terms of the permitting process. If, in fact, the alignment and other issues come to bear, I think this could be quite meaningful work in reference to a gas supply coming in to the central corridor of the state, hopefully with outlying areas being affected once you have gas flowing, is really the key, Mr. Chairman.
So the question that I asked, where's private enterprise, I haven't heard the answer. Again, is there pipeline companies interested in coming in and doing this project, or is this just another scoping project being financed by the state?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. We have met with not only the producers, we have met with pipeline companies. Joe attended those meetings. The work that we're completing now, we keep referencing the $400 million, is work that this state must do on its own before any pipeline company or any other company is going to engage. It's work the state needs to do. We have, in our meetings, have had a great deal of interest from builder, owner, operators, if you will, around the country that would be very much interested in this project. Once that work is completed and that company starts seeing that this is a real effort going forward, as I stated earlier, I work with the producers in exchange of information to try and determine any type of alignment or what's in the best interest is ongoing. We've had some difficulty with that only in the fact, and I'm not trying to be argumentative here, but we have work bills before that are out there in terms of getting us our confidentiality agreements, which has presented a problem for us in terms of people not willing to share at the level we need simply because we can't protect that data. And hopefully there'll be some resolution to that. But the work is going very well, Mr. Chairman.
Concerns me when private enterprise doesn't show up at all at the table yet. The overlap of data with the GIA, what's the status of that? How much information are we buying, paying for twice?
To my knowledge, Mr. Chairman, none. We have arrived at arrangements where we have started to concentrate most of our work from Fairbanks South, while their work continues up north for that very reason, so that we're not duplicating. In meetings that we've had, I have stated to the parties that I had made a promise to the legislature that we would not duplicate and spend the same dollars to monitor air quality from the same stations, and we're not doing that. So we are sharing data, and at all possible opportunities are not duplicating any of the work.
I thought you mentioned on the phone the other day that there was some duplication. Is that not correct?
I don't recall.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Joe Dubler, we have been in close contact with the APP, the Alaska Pipeline Project, the AGEA project. The biggest issue we're having in those communications is the confidentiality. They've brought maps in and showed us our project overlaid on their project, but when they leave, they take the maps with them. So we're able to actually look at what they're doing. They show us where they're gathering data, but we can't keep that so that we can plan ours as well. I would anticipate because of that there will be some overlap. I don't know that there has been because, like I said, we don't have their maps to look at on a day-to-day basis. We've been able to sit down in a half-hour meeting and look at them and see that they are doing work along the same corridor that we are. Most of the work they were doing wasn't the same type of work we're doing. There's lots of different data gathering that's required for a project like this, everything from rivers and streams, bird surveys. You got to do vegetation. You've got to do fish surveys. You got to do stream crossings. So they're doing some of the work, and I think we're doing some different work Undoubtedly, we are covering a lot of the same ground. There will be some overlap. What we're hoping to do is get a confidentiality agreement in place that they're comfortable with so that we can sit down and have very meaningful discussions about what where their work is progressing and where our work is progressing so that the state doesn't spend $1.90 for a dollar's worth of information.
Okay. Well, I think you'll probably find a little bit of caution on that dealing with what's going on with the GIA and the amount of money we've spent and what we're getting out of it. In relating to that project, we were told on numerous occasions that we didn't have to worry about the three majors, people with gas, making FT commitments, that utilities would step up to the plate and take FTs, and we'd get this big line built through Canada. Yet when we talked to the utilities, they basically scoffed at that idea, that they would not take FTs without gas. The financial risk is far too extreme. So this entity that you had mentioned that expressed some interest on this 260 or 0.26 BCF, just reading your body language and listening to the way you delivered that answer, it appeared that they had no gas, that they were going to be a downstream entity of some form. So you're telling me that they're willing to take FT commitments with no gas?
Mr. Chairman, what I'm going to tell you is that I'm going to honor the commitment I made not to divulge who the firm was. But I can tell you that we wouldn't be excited about it if it wasn't an entity that could have done something on the other end, meaning there is gas involved.
Well, excuse me if I feel a little bit apprehensive. I mean, I've heard these lines before with another project just a few years ago, so I'm a little bit cautious.
Mr. Chairman, if I might to address your caution, we were cautious as well, and for the record, Joe Dubler, AGDC, we were cautious as well, which pushed us into doing an expression of interest, which we hadn't originally anticipated doing in May of 2011, and the results of that showed that we had enough gas available on the north side of the pipeline from producers, and we had enough customers on the south side of the pipeline from customers and shippers that we could fill our pipeline at 500 million cubic feet per day. So we were apprehensive as well, and we still, those were non-binding commitments. These weren't firm transportation bids. It was a non-binding expression of interest, but we were still very, very comforted by the results that we achieved, and we're working towards a binding open season at the end of 2013, and we expect to have firm transportation commitments in place for the entire capacity of the line.
Of 0.5 BCF. Is that right?
Excuse me?
0.5 BCF a day.
Right, a billion cubic feet.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, we have also been in discussions with Doyon, for instance, in the Nanana Basin, as we talked about contract versus common carrier. And the interest that people have shown, again, not a proven field, but certainly one that is of great interest. We have been in discussions with mining entities that want gas for their projects. So there's been a great deal of interest stated by private enterprise in this project. I think part of the problem we run into is that this debate has been going on for so long that it's hard to get people to get interested because they think it's just another study going on. I'd like to just stay in defense of myself. When I agreed to take this on, I've been honored. I was flattered that people had the confidence in me. I have worked awfully hard on this. I have no vested interest in this. I don't own stock. I didn't get a big pay raise. I've been working hard and have comprised a great team to do this work, and I'm proud of the work that we've done, and I wish I could. I believe in this project only because it actually continues to make headway. If I may clear up another item, this is a project that's going to be funded with revenue bonds. There's discussion that goes on that there'll be a huge influx of cash by the state. That's when I first took this, that's what I believe would be the case. I stated publicly, I think it's going to be $3-4 billion. No one's been more surprised pleasantly than I have been on the tariff numbers that we're looking at that are showing that it's a standalone project, with the only amount of money the state putting into it is the $400 million we keep referencing. There is no cash outlay by the state in any of the financial information that we've supplied or any of the testimony we've ever given out publicly around the state as we show people the numbers. So this project has some real potential. I think one of the benefits of this project is if it ends up being a go-alone, go it alone as a state, I think then what you draw into this are the producers and others that are going to figure out, not in a punitive way, but in a way that says, well, they're certainly not going to sit back while the state of Alaska is welding pipes together and moving gas off the North Slope without some type of involvement. And I had that statement made to me by a representative from Exxon and others that they're certainly going to want to have an equity piece equivalent to the amount of gas that's flowing. And so I think as we continue to make progress, we have a real potential here to do something. I have been in numerous debates over we need a bigger line, and I agree with all that. But at the end of that bigger line, you better have an awfully large commercial activity paying for it. As I've stated, the incremental cost of a 48-inch line from Prudhoe Bay to Fairbanks is $2.8 billion. And so a bigger line is good for huge commercial application. I think that's a wonderful idea. I hold out my reservations on that. That's the work that AGEA has been working on. We've avoided that because we had a $500 million limitation, and there was already state activity pursuing that very idea. I know when people say, well, you can't do it with a smaller line. Well, yeah, you can. And I like to ask people, what's your alternative? If, in fact, the dire conditions that we see going on, and not only Fairbanks, but rural, this isn't going to solve rural's problems immediately. And if, in fact, the discoveries in Cook Inlet don't turn out to be as large as people anticipate, we don't know that yet. This bill, HB 369, was a result of a possible belief by some that the big line wasn't going to go. I commend Mayor Sullivan in Anchorage when he held brownout practice. That got everybody engaged, and all of a sudden, we've moved forward. So I just like to remind people that the whole intent of this was to, if need be, get gas to Alaskans, and the beauty of a commercial application, if you could, would be to keep the tariffs lower. And I'll stop with this. One of the goals that we always had, Senator, was that we must be able to beat the price of imported LNG, and we have done that in this analysis, and that number is currently about $14 to $16 per MCF. The tariffs, as we've established, coming into Anchorage at $9.63 and about $10.33 in the Fairbanks, certainly have defeated. I've stated if you can't beat imported LNG, then this is a futile effort. It should stop immediately.
I'm not questioning that you don't have good intention, but what I'm questioning is where's private enterprise? And I look to the prison that we just built, and the state is not a shining model of bigger projects, and this project is substantially built larger than, you know, a couple $100 million prison. So if we turn it upside down, we're not turning upside down a $50 million fish hatchery or a $250 million prison. We got the ability here to actually impact the state. And I think it's just bad business practices to go forward with a project without private enterprise at your side. Just my personal opinion, and maybe it all comes together in the end, but I'm just a little skeptical, and red flags go up even more when I hear about all the privacy issues. And we've had all these lines delivered to us on AGEA, and we're going to be $500 million down the drain. You know, I don't want to see another 400 of wallpaper, because with $900 million, we could pretty much fix Fairbanks' problem. That's the concern, I mean, is the magnitude of what we're dealing with. So,
well, Senator, I agree with you. The $400 million is the price that this state needs to pay to get industry at your side. Because as you look at the trumpet curve and that graph we always use, the FEL 1, 2, and 3, all along the process, you reach milestones or benchmarks where you make determinations if you should proceed. There's always the fail-safe mechanism that you make the determination that this project is not worthwhile pursuing. But unfortunately, to get to that determination, you have to spend some money to prove that.
Right.
And
whose money? But let's go on. That's the issue of the discussion here.
Well, the $400 million, Senator.
Senator Hoffman.
Well, you know, we when we were dealing with our smaller energy projects throughout the state of Alaska that we work with AEA, we made a condition in there that, you know, even though they're $1-5 million projects, they and we awarded them, none of them could go forward unless there is a power purchase agreement. You know, and I guess that's what the chairman is talking about. We could have went ahead and issued a lot of those grants to organizations, and many of them have not come to fruition because they did not have a power purchase agreement, and you know, and rightfully so. I think that's what the chairman is talking about. I can see the enthusiasm, but we have a fiduciary responsibility on expending dollars. You know, that's our responsibility, and one of the requirements isn't enthusiasm. So you had mentioned one area, and I would like to see if I can get a map or a list of mines that you said that could potentially benefit by this line. I'd like to get a copy of that because there are a few of them in my district, either a map or a list.
Yeah, I suppose we should go on, and we got a list here. We're going to burn a little too much of the clock. We might want to come back and talk about this subject later.
But may I just say one thing, Senator, to respond, and that is I'm not advocating that we are off building pipelines. There's going to be discussions with the producers, builder operators. Never have you hear me utter the words. I've said that the state could be an equity participant and an owner in this. I've never advocated that the state operate and do this. I couldn't agree with you more that there are firms out there. But to get those firms interested, this state needs to spend some money to show them that it's a real project, because they're not going to spend this money.
If that doesn't raise you a red flag, I don't know what does. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. just briefly here, on and I'm not sure we have the same page numbers here, but on page 11 and going on to page 12, needs addressed by the project. But before you look at that, the first question is, the expression of interest, was that from in-state users or people that had planned to export gas?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, we didn't make a distinction in the expression of interest. It was open to anybody. It was open from anybody all along the alignment. It was just a broadcast request for expression of interest. There was no distinction made.
But I would assume by the people that you identified that made the expression of interest, you would know whether they were going to export the gas or whether it was import, because that's why I'm mentioning page 12. It says that one of the purposes of the project or needs to be addressed is the decline of the fields in Cook Inlet that may not meet demand as early as 2014. And that's the second question. Do you believe that's the case? And I guess that's why it's critical whether we're talking about the demand and the expression of interest being for exportation of the gas or whether it was intended to be used in Cook Inlet. If, in fact, Cook Inlet does have 9, 10, 20 trillion cubic feet of gas, that cancels out the project, the same concern I've expressed before.
Well, through the chair, Senator Thomas, if the state of Alaska maximum need that is currently envisioned for a number of years is 240 million feet, and we have an expression of interest at 260 million feet, that gas has to go someplace. And I'm trying to lead it into, one would assume that it's probably not going to be used locally. Does that make sense?
Well, if you're saying it's for export, I guess that makes sense to continue on. But if it's not for export, it concerns me because I'm not sure I agree any longer with your statement on page 12, I guess is what it amounts to.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, for the record, Joe Dubler again. As Dan stated, there's half a billion cubic feet going through this pipeline. The rail belt only uses less than 250 million cubic feet. The other 250 million cubic feet is leaving the state.
Well, that's the simple answer, I guess.
Well, I guess, you know, we're going to have to move on here, but that just creates another problem. I mean, the whole idea to gasify the state, you know, you would shift demand and hopefully build some industry off of the gas. So if we're constrained to 0.5 and we sell it all and build a line and we can't expand it, that's a whole other set of problems.
Mr. Chairman, to the extent that the AGIA restriction is lifted either through the licensee abandoning the license or the state determining that they're not actively pursuing it, the 500 million cubic feet or half a billion cubic feet restriction would go away. And this line, as it's currently designed, the 24-inch, 2,500 PSI with additional compression, could go up to a billion cubic feet per day. So we would be able to accommodate a significant increase in in-state activity.
Okay. Well, we better go on. This livens us up. And I'd like to finish up Alaska Housing at least today, so, because I know you guys have got other things on your agenda. So if you could, Mr. Falsky, in the next 7 minutes, go through and we'll stop you. Well, you probably won't make it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we can, in the sense that so many of these things have repetitive through many years, but I'd like to introduce Les Campbell, our budget director, to take us down to the list you've seen many, many times through the years.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Les Campbell. I'm the budget director for Alaska Housing. The next project on the list there is the domestic violence rental assistance. This is a new project. The reference number is 54796. It's a request for $1,328,400 of general fund. Dollars. And the purpose of this authorization is to provide rental assistance to victims of domestic violence or sexual assault who have been displaced or otherwise are in need of alternate housing to prevent further harm to the household. Some of the outcomes would be rental assistance for up to 150 households going statewide who are displaced from permanent housing or otherwise at risk of displacement because of recent or reoccurring instances of domestic violence as defined by Alaska statute.
Yeah, let's go to the next one. Okay.
The next project is a statewide project improvements, reference number 40068. The request is for $2 million of corporate dividends. The purpose of this project is to provide funding to address known and unknown conditions in AHFC housing stock. Again, the outcomes are advancements in providing funding for emergency repairs, roof replacements, fire alarm systems, allowing quick response to code changes and life safety issues, providing amenities not programmed, allowing quick response to unforeseen conditions, and enhancing operations for individual projects, developments.
Just a list. Can we get a list of what the last 3 years have been spent on? The last $6 million, that's three fiscal years
of the projects that have been done.
Yes.
And you can just get that type of stuff back to the committee. We'll pass it around.
Okay. The next project is building system replacement program, reference number 47069. The request is for $1,500,000 of corporate dividends, and the purpose of this program is to address the specific major repair and replacement identifies in a five-year review. It would reduce maintenance costs, increase the useful life of the structures, and increase safety for the tenants. This is an ongoing program to replace those component parts. Okay. The next project is the fire protection systems, reference number 47066, a request for $2,200,000 of corporate dividends. Purpose is to flush, evaluate, and make life safety code repairs to public housing fire protection systems throughout the state. The projected outcomes is to have reductions in maintenance costs, to increase the useful life of the structures, and increase safety of our tenants. This is an ongoing project, and it's projected to go a couple more fiscal years as well. The next project is the security systems replacement upgrades, reference number 47068. Request for $500,000 of corporate dividends, and the purpose is upgrade existing security and door access systems to senior disabled and multifamily public housing complexes. Projected outcomes is to increase security for residents, reduce theft and vandalism, reduce maintenance and custodial costs, and increase the useful life of the structures. Anchorage has mostly been completed. Fairbanks is close to completion, and this funds would work on the Juneau area. The next project on the list is the Supplemental Housing Development Program, reference number 6323. The request is for $2,559,800 of corporate dividends and $4,440,200 of state general funds. Purpose of the program is to supplement the federal housing funds provided to regional housing authorities to ensure safe, decent, and affordable housing throughout the state. Projected outcomes are construction of affordable homes in up to 20 urban and rural communities, to build on-site water and sewer facilities, to provide energy-efficient design features in the homes, construct roads to project sites, provide electrical distribution systems, retrofit homes to provide a safe, healthy, workable home environment, and provide clients with new, safe, energy-efficient, comfortable housing. This is for stock that is not owned by Alaska Housing, but the regional housing authorities. The next project is energy efficiency monitoring research, reference number 6351. It's $1 million of corporate dividends. The purpose of the project is to conduct research, analysis, and information dissemination and interchange among members of the industry, as well as between the industry and the public. This is an ongoing project, and it's a designated grant to the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks. The next project is the Senior Citizen Housing Development Program, reference number 6334. The request is for $4,500,000 of state general funds, and the purpose of the program is to provide funds for the development of senior citizen housing and accessibility modifications to seniors' residences. To date, this program has funded 1,209 senior units and provided accessibility modifications to over 150 homes. The project outcomes for this funding is for three development projects, or about 30 units. Modifications for accessibility for approximately 40 units, and to provide technical assistance for grants for building capacity and organizations that develop senior housing. These program funds are used only to fund the development gap, or in other words, the amount necessary to make the project financially feasible, or the difference between all other funding sources which can be expected to be contributed, including loan funds, and the cost of the development projects. The next project is the HUD Federal Home Grant Program, reference number 6347. The request is for $750,000 in corporate dividends to work as a match for $3,300,000 in federal receipts. The purpose of this program is to expand the supply of affordable, low, and moderate income housing and to strengthen the ability of the state to design and implement strategies to achieve an adequate supply of safe, energy-efficient, and affordable housing. This program has funded 44 rental projects containing 818 units and rehabilitated 373 low-income homes. It has assisted another 315 homes in low-income households to purchase homes, or it has assisted another 315 families of low-income households to purchase homes.
Okay, we're going to stop there for the day. We'll pick it back up at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Okay. Finish that off. Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would request a report from AHFC on the beginning balance of this proposed fiscal year, level of funds available under AHFC receipts, dividends, and how much they plan to expend, how much they're going to be receiving under this budget, and what would be the balance at the end of the fiscal year.
Is that
for for the entire budget is...
Or AHFC dividends.
Dividends budgets.
Yes.
Okay.
I guess there's some of the concerns that have been expressed, you might as well try to wrap that in there too. Kind of a feel for what you think may be coming over the next few years, the AFC and the dividend, because, you know, the interest rate, interest rates have been pushed so low. There's concern in multiple areas of the permanent fund and our retirement system dealing with dividend impacts and interest rates. Mr. Falski.
Mr. Chairman, would it be possible, I don't mean to be just, is it possible to do this at 9 tomorrow morning instead of 1 tomorrow afternoon?
Well, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, we've got oil set up to do the oil bill and doing other committee work in the afternoon trying to get the oil tax issue done. So do you have a scheduling challenge or?
I do. I was scheduled, but I'll see what I can do to change it. I looked earlier and it was difficult. I have to be.
We'll get with you after this meeting and figure out what we'll do. We just need to stay on track. The intent of the committee is to do the normal committee work in the afternoon and concentrate on oil in the morning, so we can get some of this, you know, stuff done. 90-day session doesn't work. And so it's inconvenient for a lot of people. Anyway, so tomorrow morning we'll convene at 9 a.m. and we'll continue, I think tomorrow up, first up is scheduled to have Department of Revenue to walk through the oil tax bill and to, or any other subjects related to that, to start us off on that discussion. We are adjourned.